Welcome to episode 3 of the Vet Show, brought to you by Complete Racing Solutions. Coach Rob, how are we on this beautiful Friday afternoon?
Good afternoon, my man. And it's always good to see you. We were just teasing it. It seems like the distance and time that we have to get caught up seems to feel longer than every 4 to 5 weeks. So it's great to hear your voice and see you again. And I'm very excited about this show today.
I know this is going to be a good one. I know this is like my favorite time of the month is when I get to, when me and you get to sit down and we do the vet show and just to talk to you, because you're just a wealth of knowledge, Coach.
Well, I appreciate it very much. And I don't want everybody to think that we're just doting all over each other, but I think we have a mutual respect for each other. And speaking of respect, I would like to say a huge thanks to all the subscribers. The number of views on this show have surpassed my expectations, to be honest with you. And I know you were kind enough and you said that some people have reached out to you saying that they're digging the show. And we love to hear that. This isn't an ego show for either you nor I. The fact that we can fill a void for our fellow vet riders, I'm glad that the show has been well received. We have some really cool guests lined up. And obviously when those fall into place is to be determined on the guest schedule. But I'm really excited about who we have lined up and some of the things that we'll be able to discuss. And I don't like to use the words expose, but kind of get underneath the surface a little bit instead of just the superficial, hey, how are you? How's the track? How do you like the bike? Oh, no, no. Yeah. Let's get in. What's going on behind the ears and how do you transition from here to there? And like today, how do you get ready for a big, big national when it's kind of our bread and butter? It's going to be an interesting conversation.
Yeah. And that's going to be today's topic. That's Mammoth Motocross. It's the big Mammoth. It's more than a vet race, right? But it's, this is one of the big vet races of the year that we look forward to. Coach, I don't know if you've ever been to Mammoth, but it is a beautiful scenery, beautiful track, just lots to do. Have you checked it out before?
I would be lying to you if I said yes. Unfortunately, every time of the dirt, that time of the year when the event happens, usually our triathlon mark is at full steam and it's just, I can't be two places at once. Between this and the World Vets, my goal is to be out there in November of this year for World Vets. I know we're talking about Mammoth today, but no, sir, I have not been there. I've seen just great pictures of it. We have a mountain bike division as well. So obviously they do quite a bit up there. It does seem like a beautiful venue. I don't know that I would enjoy the, you got to vacate the property and then we'll get back in line and come back in. That sounds like it's a little bit of a logistical nightmare, but the race itself is, sounds like an incredible opportunity. Would you happen to know, as we're getting this conversation started, what is the elevation at Mammoth?
I think it's like 7,000 feet. I mean, it's very high. And so we have some questions. I got some listener questions, Coach, from some of the listeners, regarding Mammoth and how to prep and, the elevation. That's the big one, is because the air is thin when you get that high. And, not only does your body, and I want to talk to you about that as well.
Sure.
The physics and, you know, the way your body responds and reacts to the altitude, but also the bikes. It's a huge detriment to power up there. And so we'll talk a little bit about that too. But just so I'll kind of paint the picture before we kind of dive deep. But Mammoth is like I said, it's a beautiful spot. It's one of those places and races. I know, Coach, I hear a lot of wives. They always kind of bitch and complain, you know, we always go to the races on our vacation, you know, and it's like a long weekend and we're stuck in the RV at the racetrack and, you know, there's nothing for me to do. I'm going to get all this hate mail now, watch, from all the women, all the wives, but Mammoth is a beautiful spot to take your family. There's tons to do. You can rent some really nice Airbnbs, but they've got the hiking, mountain biking, fishing, you name it, outdoorsy. It's beautiful. So you legitimately could take the whole week and go on a very nice, relaxing vacation and also hit a race. So that's what Mammoth is.
It's funny you say that. I have a dear friend, John Watkins, out of Georgia, and he did exactly that. Him and his son, they registered for Mammoth. But what he did was he bought a set of adventure bikes and they'd drive for a day, they'd park, they'd spend the entire day doing their adventure bikes, get back in the trailer, motorhome, drive to the next one. And they did that all the way out to Mammoth, raced Mammoth, and then stayed afterwards, did some adventure bike, and then made their way back. And to this day, he still talks about what an incredible memory that was for him and his son. And so to your point, exactly, it can be a true memory maker that not just the race itself, like you said, it sounds like that week, incredible opportunity for everybody to just kind of relax. And just out of curiosity, what kind of temperatures at that height, you know, being that high in the sky there, the elevation rather, does it, what's the highest temperature that's during the week? What do we see? What are we looking at?
It's usually high 70s, low 80s. Okay. You know, there's been years where it's been hot, you know, mm-hmm. it's got 90s, but generally the weather's fairly mild from what I can remember. You know, it's just a nice, you're in the mountains essentially. So, but it's beautiful.
Well, people don't have a tendency to remember, and I know I don't want this to sound insulting, but at 7,000 feet, you're 7,000 feet closer to the sun. So the propensity to getting sunburn, and this is kind of a double-edged sword, the air temperature is comfortable, but the exposure to the sun is a lot more. So not that that's one of the questions. Oh, speaking of the questions, Dan, I want to make sure all of our listeners understand, we got a multitude of questions that came in, and we apologize. We're not going to be able to get to all of them, but we don't want you to be discouraged by that. Obviously, we try to keep these shows around an hour long for out of respect of your time. But I do want to say thank you for all of them that kind of bombarded you with the questions. It's cool to see that we have such a following in such a short period of time. So I'm very appreciative of that. But I also want to acknowledge we won't be able to get to all of them. So please accept our apologies for that. So hopefully you guys understand.
Yeah, but please keep sending them, because some of the questions that we got were very good, very good legitimate questions for Mammoth Prep. So, Coach, let's get into it. Do you want to get into the first question that I got from one of our listeners?
Yeah, let's go ahead and keep that thread of thought moving. When do you want to grab the bull by the horns and talk a little bit about the bike? And
sure.
And you'll see why here in a moment. I think it'd be helpful. When you're looking at the limitations of a bike, you know, when we look at something like a Thunder Valley, it's the big discussion point. How do we not allow the gasoline to boil? And we're probably better off running pump gas. And nonetheless, it's going to be a horsepower game. What is your recommendation, knowing those characteristics coming in? And I don't know how much you're at liberty to talk about it. What do the factory teams do when they're put in a situation like that? What are you able to share?
Yeah, so a lot of factory teams, I mean, you have a high altitude setting, right? They actually build these engines for the high altitude, like Pro Circuit for example, or Star. Mm-hmm. They're building an engine specifically for the altitude, where they're actually increasing the compression quite a bit from their standard setting, right? So they can get some of that horsepower back. They could still run some of their race gas and things like that to try to minimize a huge change in, you know, the fuel that they're running and so on and so forth. A lot of times, you know, us blue collar working folk, we can't just build motors for altitude, right?
Right.
Some of our people, they do have that ability, but most of us don't, right? And so it's a huge issue when you get that high, is to trying to get your bike dialed in or that thin air. And that we had a lot of questions, Coach, come in regarding this specifically, because when you get up there in altitude, the bike is substantially slower. And it's, how do I get some of that power back? And I'll get into it. It was a listener question that came in from Austin that wanted to know what he can do to make his bike. He is a Honda 250.
Okay.
What can he do to regain some of his power? And so, you know, not wanting to spend a lot of money on this, you could, the best and easiest way to do that would be to get your ECU remapped. And there's a few different ways of doing that. You could send your stock ECU to one of the tuners like HP or Twisted or XPR, somebody that's reputable, send it to them, let them map your stock ECU, but just know there's limitations as to what they can do with the stock ECU. If you're somebody that is going to Mammoth every year, or you're riding in a lot of different elevations, I would highly suggest getting an aftermarket ECU. The Vortex ECUs are very popular. The Get ECUs are good. There's a few different ones out there. Those are probably the two most popular, but those tuners, coach, they you know, the XPR and HP, they're familiar with those platforms and they've got a lot of experience with those. So get yourself a Vortex, let one of those guys build you know, a high elevation map for you. They'll adjust the fuel trims, the timing of the ECU, and your bike will run much, much better at those elevations.
My dear friend Derek, who obviously owns HP Development, he does the navigating amateur motocross with me. He's going to probably hang me from a closest tree here. This is an ignorant question. By the textbook definition, I'm ignorant on this, because the last bike that I really raced competitively, I was still on carburetors, right? So if we go to something like that, it's like, okay, we got to play with the jetting. Really ignorant question, and I hope the subscribers and the listeners don't hate me for it. How can you detune the bike? I live in Florida, right? I'm about as at sea level as you can possibly get, but I know I'm going to Mammoth. What do I do to the bike? Let's just stay on your thread of thought of an ECU. If the ECU is reprogrammed for that thin air, I can't come and ride that down here in Florida. I guess my question is, and we talk a lot about this in the amateur motocross, trying to keep the deviation between your practice bike and your race bike, keep that as minimal as possible. A lot of people don't realize the pro bikes, you're talking less than 0.5% of deviation between their practice bike and the race bike. Obviously, resources are much more plentiful. How would I in Florida tweak the bike to get it to lose the horsepower that better emulates what I'm going to be experiencing when I'm up there? If I'm on a four stroke or a two stroke for that matter, I know it's two different, but
yeah, you in that's a drastic change in elevation, right? You're never going to make a bike that slow at sea level to be able to compensate or to get relative what power you're going to experience at 7,000 feet.
And I think that's absolutely imperative. And obviously we haven't coined this conversation, but if I go off of what you're just saying, how many times have we been shell-shot? Like you jump on your buddy's bike and it just doesn't snap the way yours does. Well, think about how that negatively impacts your ability to come into a corner or accelerate out of a corner and maybe seat bounce a jump or a step on, step off or something. Can you imagine all of a sudden you're losing 20% of your horsepower? If you don't practice that, that's like going and jumping on your buddy's bike at a track you've never been to before and almost doing it with one eye closed, because the characteristics are completely off, you know, preloading and all the stuff that we do. So based on your experience, what would I do being in Florida? Do I just go and get a bike that's got 300 hours on it and it's about as tired as it could possibly be and lacking power?
Honestly, if it was me, and say I was riding 450s, right? Which I don't really. I have a few of them, but I prefer my 250. But
yeah,
if I was going to go to Mammoth, I would ride a 450 because you really need all the power you can get, right? But to practice on, if I was training for Mammoth, I'd probably jump on a 250 at sea level.
And then would you go a 125 if you're on a 250 and then go a PW50 if you're on an 85?
I don't know. For me, coach, like jumping, going back and forth from two stroke to four stroke is tough for me because just the way the motorcycles handle, you know, with the engine braking, no engine braking on a two stroke, it's just, they're very different for me. I struggle going from two stroke to four stroke, but, that's probably what I would do.
That makes sense.
Some people don't have that luxury of having two bikes. You're just really going to have to make do. The nice thing with the Vortex ECUs is you can have them mapped. The box holds 10 maps.
Okay.
So you can have some elevation maps, you can have some sea level maps, and anywhere in between. And one of the nice things with the Vortex as well is some of the well-known tuners like Twisted and XPR, some of the guys that are out here on the West Coast, they attend Mammoth. And if you go see them, they can get you guys dialed in right there at the racetrack.
There you go. Well, and the reason why I was asking so much, because the mechanical side is, I know just enough to be dangerous, as the old saying goes. And the reason why I was asking is, if we jump over on the other side of the equation, the physical side, right? One of the biggest complaints that I hear is, I essentially got my body dialed to do this. Now think about what the word this represents. How hard does your bike hit coming out of the corners? How long do you have it? What do you have it geared for? Is it geared to pop out of the corner and signs off quick? That changes the disposition on the way we ride the bike. If you're having to short shift a four stroke because you added two teeth to the rear, that changes your body position. That changes how busy you are on the bike. That completely, the demands physically are dramatically different. Now, that may sound like a Captain Obvious statement while we're just sitting here comfortable in an afternoon, but I've heard the frustrations of athletes that have gone to Mammoth and they're like, I was like waiting on the bike. Okay. Well, when you're waiting on the bike, if I'm videoing you, you have a tendency to become lazy. So that would be my number one recommendation for anybody going to Mammoth. Catch yourself and not allow yourself to become lazy. You know how it is, like if you're riding like a TTR 110, right? You're playing around and you just, you get on the gas, come out of a corner. You know how you just kind of sit there and you're like waiting for it to pull, or you're riding a street bike like a Grom. You know, it doesn't have that two-stroke power band where you're just waiting for it to snap your arms off. What we do is we get lazy. We start looking down. We start dropping our elbows. We find ourselves sitting more because we're waiting on the bike. But if we were all to go and convert, no matter what bike you're on, let's say that, since we're talking to the vets, let's say that you go from a 450 or a 250 four-stroke and you jump on a YZ125, right? All of a sudden, you know, that's not a lazy man's bike. We got to keep it in that little prime spot. Well, you're much busier on the bike. And that's the visual I want everybody to have. One of the challenges associated with Mammoth is you're going to have to fight the propensity of becoming lazy because there's such a lack of horsepower. And that's why I was wondering if there was something you could do to emulate that lack of punch, that lack of acceleration. Because think about it, and we've done this with you, even with your training program, you get a bike that's super fresh, you've got a brand new set of tires. But when you crack that throttle coming out of the corner and you get that ideal hookup, if you don't have that death grip with those inner thigh muscles, the adductors, if you're not sitting down, squeezing, I'm not just talking about pushing the outside leg down. I'm not talking about just holding the inside leg up, but literally from your pubic bone where the adductor inserts to the inside of your knee. If those aren't putting an absolute death grip and you go to crack the throttle, your bum bounces backwards, especially if there's acceleration bumps. But when was the last time you isolated the adductor muscle? It's a very, very hard muscle to engage in the gym off the bike. I know it sounds silly. Remember the old Susan Summers Thigh Master?
Yeah.
Every motocross guy should have one. They don't exist anymore. So what I recommend is those big bouncy fit balls. Some people call them a TheraBall or whatever. Yeah. And they come in different sizes. Literally sit on the edge of the bench, put one of those fit balls in between your knees. Gently, keyword gently, move in, contract, hold it for 5 to 8 seconds, relax, don't let the ball drop. Do 8 or 10 of those, do 3 sets of them. You will seriously feel from your pubic bone to the inside of your knee, you'll feel it. But here's there's always a caveat, right? I've seen guys actually rip that bone, that muscle right off the pubic bone, because we're racers, right? If 2 is good, 4 must be twice as good. So they get a hold of that fit ball and they squeeze the living crap out of it. And next thing you know, they pop their adductor off their pubic bone. And it's, if you've ever pulled a groin muscle, a pulled adductor, multiply your pulled groin muscle by 5 to 10. That's how bad it hurts. And there's no healing it except inactivity and sitting with a big bag of frozen vegetables on your groin.
Doesn't sound fun.
No, but that's why I have a responsibility. How could I eliminate that stutter bump acceleration with my bum moving back? You have to squeeze the crap out of the bike under full acceleration. Now, here's where we go back to the conversation on Mammoth. See how you can become lazy and all of a sudden you're not really holding the bike because the bike doesn't really snap like it normally does. Next thing you know, you're pushed off the back of the bike, not because the bike was fast, but because you weren't gripping the bike firmly. And now you're complaining about arm pump.
Yeah.
See the domino and the cascade effect of this? Yep. That's what we have to desperately try to avoid. So that's why I was asking, how do I practice at sea level what the body's going to have to endure with a lack of horsepower up there? That's why I was asking you the feedback on it.
Yeah, it's tough. It's tough because it's not, you know, it's not like going from sea level to Fernley, Nevada. We have Fernley, a sand track here. It's like 3,000 feet, you know, which is...
Yeah.
Is up there, you know, but it's nothing like Mammoth. Mammoth is twice that. So
yeah,
it's tough because you're going from one extreme to the other.
Yep.
You just kind of got to make do. And you know what it is, Coach, too? It's experience. right? It's the experience that you learn over the years by going there or riding in the elevation on what to do, like how to set your bike up and how it's going to respond. Like if you're going there for the first time, you're going to be like, these guys said my bike was going to be slow, and they're going to come back to like, yep, they were right.
Yeah. Well, and that's the hard part with physiology is I can say to you that if you warm up, you'll feel better than if you don't. And then someone doesn't warm up, goes, has a bad race, warms up, comes back and goes, yep, you were right. I don't need to be proven right. I'm just trying to avoid the frustration that you just articulated to right there. Because once you buy that t-shirt and you're frustrated beyond belief, well, what's happened is we've deviated away from you actually racing to your potential. It's kind of like I'll get a phone call on a Monday and somebody will be irritated about their race results. And we do a brief conversation and we find out they ate dinner at 6 p.m. on Friday. They got up in the morning, drove to the track, got the first round of practice in. By the time the first moto came, they've lost all their sizzle. And they're like, I've got to get myself in shape. And I'm like, hold on, hold on. You went from 6 p.m. to now 11 a.m. Do the math. You're 17 hours since your last meal. You don't think you have low blood sugar? And they're like, oh gosh, that makes sense. Well, your brain's ability to process speed is directly correlated to the blood sugar levels in your liver. Your liver feeds your brain. But listen to what the frustration was. The frustration was, why is my reaction time so slow? Why am I missing my marks? Why am I making an easy turn, a three-point corner? Because your depth perception is off because of low blood sugar, because it's been 17 hours. It's not a fitness issue. It's a nutrition issue. Yeah. So same thing here. You go to Mammoth, you get lazy, you don't squeeze. Now you're complaining of arm pump. It goes back to what we've spoken about on the Coach Rob podcast. The problem is you're not differentiating the difference between the source of the problem versus the actual, we say there's a difference between the site, the pain site versus the pain source. So for example, when someone's lower back bothers them, your lower back is where it hurts, but the problem is actually because you have tight quadriceps and it's pulling the pelvic girdle down and forward, which creates curvature in the lower back. So when someone complains to me on a rough track like Mammoth, hey, I got arm pump. Is that because you're sitting down low, dropping your elbows and not squeezing the bike? You see how we reverse engineer the arm pump?
Yeah.
Then you throw in there a bike that doesn't accelerate. It makes us become lazy because now we're not worried about all this excessive process speed. We kind of feel like we're in slow motion almost. Of course, then you look at some of the parts of Mammoth and you're going downhill. It probably is not once, but three times the normal pace.
Yeah.
So it goes from one extreme to the other.
Yeah.
Just an FYI for you. The reason why I was asking about the air temperature is warming up. This is something that I think a lot of people have a tendency to forget about. When that air temperature continues to go lower and lower, you have to warm up for a longer period of time. One of the mistakes I see people doing is like, well, I've got a big jacket on, so I'm not cold. Well, there's a difference between being, let's go the other extreme. If you're sitting at Loretta's and you're sweating profusely, your body is warm relevant to the heat, but it's not metabolically warmed up. Most people can resonate with that example. Go the other extreme. If it's cold and you're sitting with a big jacket on and you're warm, that doesn't mean you're metabolically warmed up. Make sense?
Yeah.
Because this is how people end up tearing muscles, just like a piece of metal. If you put that in frozen water and then you take that metal out and you try to bend it, it's brittle, it breaks. Well, if a tendon or a ligament isn't adequately warmed up, most people think about only the muscle, and that's obviously part of the equation. But remember, muscles attach to bone through tendons. So if there isn't a lot of good warm blood, tendons and ligaments, as most of our listeners know, doesn't already have good blood flow. That's why it takes forever for those doggone things to heal. You can tear a muscle because there's so much blood flow. It heals very, very quickly. That's why I wanted to just kind of, while you were on that thread of thought, let's not overlook the warm-up, because the warm-up becomes the piece that eliminates an injury. It's kind of like when someone says they get arm pump. Well, you're not squeezing the bike with your inner thigh muscles. They only focus on arm pump, not what they're not doing.
Right.
We hear people come out of cold environments. They thought they were warm. They weren't warmed up. They end up pulling or straining a tendon or a muscle. So while you mentioned that, I just wanted to throw that out there.
That's actually good, because it makes total sense, but I've really never thought much about that. Mm-hmm. But how would you know, what would be a good indicator or temperature on when to change your warm-up routine? Is it you know, 10 degrees, 15 degrees, like when, how should you adjust based on the temperature?
The good news is you don't have to adjust it. You just need to do a warm up. I may have articulated that incorrectly. What people don't understand is if you warm up back at your rig and it's more than a 10 or 15 minutes before you're going to get on the gate, you've essentially just wasted those energy calories warming up because now your body has come back down and now you got to get kind of warmed back up again. Think about it. That warm up was for nothing. You warmed up to essentially ride to pre-staging. Waste of calories. Right. Let's make one assumption that you're fit, right? I have had some guys like warm up. I'd be tired if I warmed up. Well, all jokes aside, let's assume that you're fit enough that you can do a warm up and still race. But the magical number is 20 minutes. What you're looking for, give yourself 10 minutes of even tempo, heart rate zone 2, and then just do a 10 minute heart rate ladder in zone 3. And what that means is let's use two numbers very loosely, 150 to 160. So for 10 minutes, you're literally just going to do 30 seconds on, 30 seconds off. And the goal is don't allow yourself to go above zone 3. What you're doing is you're activating the lactic acid shuffle, the presence of lactic acid in the bloodstream. So what you don't want to do is be going, sitting on the gate with a heart rate of 90 and then go to 190 in literally, you know, one lap. Because the lactic acid, when it dumps into the bloodstream, your bloodstream isn't able to grab the lactic acid and get rid of it quickly enough because you're not metabolically warmed up. That's what we call the lactic acid shuffle. It's beyond the scope of our pod today, but it's about getting, if you understand that in the human body, the body communicates amongst itself through hormones. We hear so much about, oh, you're just a walking hormone. Hormones are the communicators in the system. So as long as people understand that, the warm-up isn't just about trying to, you know, wear you out. The warm-up is truly a metabolic, physiological benefit. When in doubt, think about your second set in the gym. You notice how the second set always feels easier. That's because the neuromuscular communication, we've talked about this on the show before. If you go to the gym and you lift 15 pounds and you do 5 reps, and then you go to 20 pounds and you go 5 reps, and then you go to 25, your brain is incrementally anticipating 30 on your next round. So that's why we don't want it to go from 0 to 100. It's going to shell shock the system. It's like you walking in the gym and just walking over and grabbing 40 pound dumbbells. It's too heavy. But if you work your way up to it, you notice how 40 is doable. So, yeah. And I know that we're going to have some of our listeners like, yeah, it must be nice to be in good enough shape. We'll talk about that here in a moment. Some, I know not everybody can train and some people are coming off the couch and we dig that. We understand it. Everybody's at different places, but if we are going to discuss the physiological side of it and we're going to mirror it up with the mechanical that you outlined, that's our purpose on today's show, is not just talk about one side of the equation. If you've got a bike that's anemic, what do we do with your body position? What are the things that you want to try to avoid when the bike is underpowered? And that was that, there was a perfect example of what we're talking about today.
Yeah, that's actually really good, because we as vets, coach, I'm guilty of it. I'll just say that straight up. I'll get to the track and I don't do a warm up half the time because I just want to ride, man. I just want to get out there and ride, you know? And you get out there and all of a sudden it's like, yeah, you could, it's a big difference when you do a warm up versus not.
Absolutely.
But we forget to, because we just want to go ride, you know, or we just don't think of ourselves as like elite athletes, you know? We're just, we're just lining up for Moto One, you know. But if you just take that, you know, 10, 15, 20 minutes to do something, it makes a big difference.
I'm going to go down a side bunny trail. Was that the Barcia commercial for the CRF 150? I want to ride, I want to ride, I want to ride. Or were they just promoting their family of bikes? I can't remember if those were together or not. I just can imagine Barcia on that 150 as it goes blowing by the screen. But I think I want to ride with them promoting just all of their bikes. But yeah. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to get on a bunny trail there. But when you're like, I just want to ride, I'm like, yeah, they did a commercial on that. And it's so true. I want to ride, I want to ride, I want to ride. Let's go. You know, well, what makes it also difficult too, Dan, is if you go to a track and you've only got a 20 minute block, right? Let's say they're breaking the hour into 3:20s. That's the hard part, because a lot of us will use 3 or 4 laps to get up to speed, get warmed up, and you're like, dadgum, it only gives me, you know, 8 more minutes to ride. I know it's not always logistically possible, but, you know, bring a mountain bike to the track and ride around and do the same 20, right? You're just doing an even tempo for 10 minutes. you're not doing mad sprints and trying to exhaust yourself. You're just trying to prime the engine, you know, kind of boom, boom, boom. You're just accumulating a little bit more of a lactic acid engagement with each 30-second interval. So it's 30 on, 30 off, 30 on, 30. And you want to be sweating profusely. When you put your helmet on, you want to be sweating, you know, like you've been out there for a while. And that kind of tricks the body into thinking it's been out there. And then I'm not saying first lap, go guts to the wall. Always go do a sight lap. You've done a camp with me, and I don't care if you've ridden that track 3 gazillion times, wheels on the ground for the first lap. You just never know what could be out there.
Yeah.
So I think question. I interrupted you. I apologize.
No, you're fine. If somebody doesn't have a mountain bike or some mm-hmm. piece of equipment to warm up with, say they got their pickup and their bike, what could give a couple of just simple exercises you could do to warm up?
Absolutely. The one that I'm a big fan of, believe it or not, is a good old fashioned jump rope. Get the one that's made out of plastic that has a little macaroni size pieces of plastic, because most of us can jump rope in our boots, believe it or not, but you need to make sure it's long enough so that you can, you know, hit the dirt and still make it underneath. Jumping jacks, walking lunges. I wouldn't get so much into the burpees, because you could actually, I mean, if you're used to doing burpees, go for it. Do things like, if you know what a Jacob's ladder is, where you're kind of on the edge of your bumper and you're just kind of bringing your knees up underneath your chest. Again, you can do all this in your boots. The idea is, and this is the beautiful part about having a wearable device like Garmin, if I can get you to reverse engineer, because this is the question I always get, what does my heart rate need to get up to validate that I'm warmed up? Well, if your resting heart rate is 50, 75, 85, you're going to be starting to prime the engine. If your resting heart rate's 85, you're going to need to be closer to 100, 110. It's all relevant to you as an individual, but there is by no means a magical number. That's why I want the listeners to remember that your max heart rate number is indigenous to yourself, specific to the discipline you're doing. So the motorcycle will always have the highest heart rate because of the amount of load, pushing and pulling and velocity. And what we have found historically is it goes, the motorcycle has the highest max heart rate. Running and the rower are pretty much identical. Then you get into gravel bike, then you'll get into road bike, then you'll get into elliptical, then you end up in swimming. So if you kind of think about it, please use these numbers loosely. If your max heart rate's 200 on the motorcycle, it's probably going to be around 190, 192 running and rower. And what I'll actually make it a little bit easier. Usually it's about a 10 beat deviation. So if max heart rate on the moto is 200, you can expect running is going to be around 190. You can go all the way down into 10 beat. People are like, wait a second, my max heart rate in the swim is 135. Yeah, because of the hydrostatic pressure. It's very hard because the hydrostatic pressure of the water is bringing the unoxygenated blood back to the heart with less and less effort. So the heart rate doesn't have to elevate. This is why swimming is such a great tool for anybody who rides, because you have less and less impact. Think about it, Dan, from your earlobes to your toenails, how much has your vertebrae taken a beating? How much has your knees taken a beating? How much have the joints in your hips taken a beating? So if you continue to put all that together, right, what ends up happening? Try to find some way to cross train that doesn't add more to the jeopardy, you know, the jarring of all the joints.
Right.
So
makes sense.
Yep. But if you go back to the track, this is another thing. Like when we go to Loretta's, I don't even have my athletes warm up at their rig because you have to be at pre-staging, I think 3 races ahead. That's an hour right there. So what you want to do, especially for the first moto, is how is it at Mammoth? How do they do first gate pick? Is it just draw the spoons?
Yeah. Usually okay. That's when I've been, that's how they do it.
And how far in advance do you have to be in pre-staging?
Oh God, I can't remember, coach.
So, I mean, if it's more than 20 minutes, save your energy. Don't even warm up.
It's more than 20 minutes.
Gotcha. Yeah. Well, for the listeners, then you know, you're not being lazy. You're not taking the low road. You're just conserving energy. This is something that we can get into here today. You've got to remember, when you've got a week-long race like that, it's always about conserving energy. Now, if I'm not mistaken, don't they run like the big bikes and the vets at definitive days, and then they run the small bikes definitive. So that helps, unlike Loretta's.
Usually the vets is like Friday, Saturday, Sunday.
Okay.
Typically, yeah.
So stop and think about that. You know, if you're there and you've got other people in your family that are racing, Do you know by chance, do they start with the small bikes and go to big bikes, or do they start with big and go to small historically?
It varies every year, but
okay.
Typically they start with the big bikes and then okay. go to small bikes. Yeah.
Well, for the sake of our listeners that are vet riders, that would work to your advantage. Let's just say for whatever oddball reason, they flip-flop the order. You've got to remember when you get there early in the week, you're trying to conserve energy to get to the end of the week as fresh as you possibly can. I don't want this to sound disrespectful or, you know, condescending at all. People have a tendency to forget that. You've got to put yourself into a position to be as fresh as possible when you get to that start of the racing. And the reason why it's so important is you got to remember that when you're in thin air, your ability to sleep at night is going to be negatively impacted. This is a difficult little trap that people put themselves in. Remember when everybody was talking about altitude tents?
Yeah.
I don't know if you remember that became real kind of a hip thing amongst some of the factory riders. I don't want to sound disrespectful to anybody, but the last thing you want to do is sleep in an altitude tent when that's the time of the day that your body's trying to rejuvenate itself. And then you're pulling the most important component out of the air, which is oxygen. That puts an undue stress on your body. Think about that. What is the responsibility, or what it rather is the goal of sleep? To allow your body to recover. Just as a simple illustration, if I were to have you lay down and go to bed and put a clothespin on your nose and then only breathe through a straw, how rested are you going to feel when you wake up tomorrow?
Yeah.
And that's the same thing. It'd be very tough. And that's what's happening is you're sleeping in thin air. So it has a negative impact on your ability to recover. So when I was hearing that there were athletes, there was a couple top guys that were doing it. And I hate to say it, but that's a mistake.
Yeah.
That's a mistake. But I don't want to just say that to sound like I'm throwing someone under the bus. Why is it a mistake? Because your body needs oxygen to facilitate recovery after a long day of riding and training and working and being a parent.
A lot of questions, Coach. We kind of talked about the bike, right? And the negative effects of the altitude and what it does to the bike as far as power.
Yep.
When you go up in altitude, I want to pick your brain on your body, because your body loses power too, because there is a lack of oxygen. And what can you do to prepare as far as training for altitude? And then what do you do when you're there and you're trying to recover?
The answer is going to surprise everybody, because again, I hope this doesn't come across as being condescending at all. When we say we're at altitude, we kind of joke that there's a minimal amount of oxygen in the air. Well, your body relies on the red blood cells running through your body to be able to grab the available oxygen and pull that to the demands of the muscle. So the number one thing that you can do is stay hydrated. I know that sounds really benign, but you've got to remember the surface area of a cell is where you carry on the surface area of the red blood cells, RBCs. That's where you're carrying the oxygen. So if you're properly hydrated, you're giving yourself a chance to deliver the greatest amount of oxygen to the muscles that you know are going to be working. So that's number one, is stay hydrated. The big question I always get is, what kind of training can I do to get ready for a lack of oxygen? Really isn't much you can do, because how am I going to strip the oxygen out of the room that I'm in, whether I'm swimming, biking, running, cross training, weightlifting, or riding my moto? That's where, unfortunately, like you said, not all of us have the discretionary funds to be able to uproot and go train at altitude for 3 or 4 weeks. That acclimatization stage, that's why you see Tomac living in Cortez. I think we've talked about this off the record. I don't know what Cortez is at elevation. Let's just say for conversation's sake, it's 3,000 feet. Well, every time Tomac leaves Cortez and comes down closer to sea level, with the exception of Utah and Thunder Valley, that's every race. So now all of a sudden his body's used to a very minimal amount of oxygen in the air. Now the air is saturated with oxygen. It makes it easier for him to go faster, and it's easier for him to sustain it. The reason why I give that example is, now reverse that. If you know that you're going up to altitude and there's going to be a limitation of oxygen, and I know some people are going to hate me for this, you're going to have to adjust your pacing. Let's take the whole conversation down to sea level. You and I decide that we're both going to run a 5K. Gun goes off and I take off like I stole something. As soon as I cross that anaerobic threshold, hence the word anaerobic threshold, the point of which I'm no longer working with oxygen, I've gone from with oxygen, I've crossed a threshold and now I've gone anaerobic, not enough oxygen to meet the demands of the muscle. You're doing that as soon as you step out of your van. You're already anaerobic to begin with. There's not enough oxygen in the air. Now you want to go out and race and be as fast as you can. So you remember how you were saying earlier, it's usually just go experience it and go, yep, there was not a lot of oxygen in the air. My motorcycle was not very fast. Unfortunately, we have no way of evaluating how fast is too fast. Now, when we say fast, we're actually going off of heart rate. When we say how fast can you go, what we're really saying is, what's the heart rate range that you can sustain with the amount of oxygen that's in the air? That's the whole idea of train high, race low. You go up high, there's a limitation of oxygen. Your kidneys will get a message from your brain that says there's an insufficient amount of oxygen. So the kidneys start producing more red blood cells. And then when you come down to altitude and the presence of oxygen is in the air and you've had, let's say you've increased, your kidneys have increased the number. We measure that in millimoles. If you measure the volume of blood that's in your body, right? If you just added 2% to that and then you come down, you've got a 2% increase in the red blood cell count. It's like moving from a 250 to a 350. You know how you feel that little bit of extra power? It's not hitting like a 450, but you can tell that little bottom end is there. That's what training at altitude does. When we come back to your original question, you've got to know you can't go out and race it like you're at sea level. You're going to have to taper your efforts just a little bit. But the good news is, if, and this is a double negative, the gate may drop and somebody may take off until they go anaerobic and then they're coming backwards. So your goal is to be right up against that glass ceiling that you never quite go across that threshold. And until you go there and you get some numbers, it's all crapshoot. So if you find yourself, you know, getting blurry vision because you literally have gone so anaerobic, just understand that once you cross that threshold, there's only one direction you can go, backwards. And that's what pisses people off. So I don't mean to be sarcastic. Refrain from crossing that threshold. It'll eliminate your frustration of going backwards. But neither you nor I can say it's this definitive number. You know, I'm from Florida. I'm sure I would get hammered on being at Mammoth.
So what you're saying, Coach, is this is an individual science experiment for everybody.
Exactly.
And we can tell you your bike's going to be slow, and we can tell you you're going to be slower too.
That's exactly
right.
Just
got to figure out what works the best.
Yep. Well, think about it. On the motorcycle, you can crack the throttle and hold it wide open, and it's only going to pull until it can't pull anymore. And its limiting factor is going to be what? The amount of oxygen in the air. The difference between a motor and yourself is, I always go back, when we were growing up, we had an XL185. And I loved that bike because we could be out on the, you know, we would be, was at my grandfather's farm in Salina, Ohio, and we would use that bike to go to other people's house. You could be on those back, you know, those farm roads, and you're in sixth gear wide open. Literally, you have it as wide open as it'll go. And it's not pulling. It's no longer accelerating because it's not a, well, that's what I want you to realize. On your motorcycle, you turn the throttle, it hits a point to where there's only so much oxygen. It can only produce so much power. Your problem with it being a human being is you don't have a governor. You don't have something that says you're against that glass ceiling until you cross it. And then you go, I can't breathe.
Yeah.
You found your anaerobic threshold at altitude. It'd be good that, and this is where, okay, we're going to give the lion's share of secrets away right here. When you go to Mammoth, the most important part is practice. Because Dan, if you go to Mammoth, you've got heart rate data from practice. Go and look at it. Hey, I felt good at 172, but when I hit 175, I was on struggle bus. Well, put your watch on the handlebar so you can see it safely without taking your eyes off the track, right? Any place that you're in the air, glance down and see what your heart rate is. Anytime you can stay below that glass ceiling and don't go anaerobic, well, that's what practice is for. Now, I'm not saying that that track is an easy track. I love the big flows and all that, but it's high speed and we don't want you to, you know, take your eyes off the track. But
no,
that's the $1 million way for someone like myself. I'm going to a venue. I have to very quickly ascertain where's my threshold at. And the only way I can do it is get out and about and put a number to it. Does that make sense at any level?
It does. But again, it's an experiment.
It is. And especially when you're, think about how much you, the rider, are trying to differentiate bike setup. Is the bike balanced? Is it compression and rebound good? do I have the right gear ratios on? Bike's not pulling at 100%. It's changing my body position on the bike. Oh gosh, I went a little too hard effort wise and now I've gone anaerobic. There's a lot of variables. I'm not trying to insult anyone's math skills, but when you've got three variables, that's 27 different varies. That's seven different ways, because it's essentially two. If you take three, right, you have three different variables, three to the third power is 27. Stop and think about it. So bike setup, the way that you're feeling, you know, the way that the motor is pulling, you have 27 different ways that the end result could be influenced. And we know that there's a lot more than just three. But if you put that in mathematical terms, is there any wonder why sometimes we're like, what the heck am I doing out here? I'm lost.
Yeah.
You know how it is. You change this and it has a domino effect over here, whether it was positive or negative. Like, what's the old saying at the factory track? You don't want to get so many pieces, you get lost. If you adjust too many pieces, you get lost in setup.
Yeah.
There's too many options. That's what this conversation about is today. Don't go there worrying about the altitude. Go there with a strategy and a plan. What could happen? You already know you're going to go anaerobic. How do I avoid it? Maintain hydration and learn and practice where that threshold is at. Now racing should be very enjoyable because you've got the parameters established. Yeah. And it's a fun one. I mean, think about it. Jason Anderson flies in at the last minute just because of the altitude sickness. It's a real deal. You know,
it is.
It's a real deal.
Real quick, I want to get to two other little things, and I do want to get to one of our listener questions too, because it's a good one. It kind of hits home to a lot of us that ride.
Yeah.
Concrete start. You're going to experience a concrete start at Mammoth. It is a odd start. It's kind of an uphill left-hander. But one thing that everybody makes a mistake at Mammoth is they try to start in second gear, because that's typically what we do at sea level. Don't even try it. First gear on everything, even a 450. You want to be in first gear, concrete start at Mammoth. And then fuel issues. We've been talking about the thin air. Coach, you hit on it earlier, fuel boiling. Right now, I don't know if you're aware, but there's a huge VP Racing fuel issue. Mm. They recalled a bunch of batches of a very popular fuel that a lot of us run in our bikes. Simply just can't get it. So if you're going to Mammoth, most guys run pump gas, believe it or not, because it solves the fuel boiling over. Again, get with your engine tuner, whoever's tuning your ECU, let them know what fuel you're running, or you're going to plan to run pump gas at Mammoth and plan accordingly for that. Anything I'm missing?
When you're talking about that concrete start, what are your recommendations on bike position, setup, technique? What's your thoughts?
It's the concrete starts are weird because, you know, you want to sit in a pretty neutral position on the bike and you can expect pretty much instant traction, right? You want to kind of lean forward a little bit, but stay neutral. You still want to get a little bit of weight on the back tire, you know, so it doesn't break loose, because you can break loose on concrete. That's why you want to stay somewhat neutral. But if you can find a place to practice some starts, even if it's out in the street, I hate recommending that to anybody. You know, find somewhere where that it's safe to, you know, and just do a couple of starts. It's tough because you're going to go from concrete to dirt. So if you can find somewhere where you can go from concrete to dirt, you're much better off, because the bike will react different once you hit that dirt. But it's definitely unique starting on concrete.
Well, and to me, my experience has been as much like whenever I do a performance camp and we're practicing starts, you know, tuck the boots up against the engine casings, leverage them against the pegs, and don't let them come out for any reason. What I see on a concrete pad is people, they don't realize that they've leaned ever so slightly, and a 1 millimeter lean is going to cause the rear end to come around. It's just simple physics.
Yeah.
So let's assume that you're able to keep the bike squeezed and the bike is accelerating off. What I see, because like you talked about, people are a little bit more upright. Well, right as that rear wheel hits the dirt, you better be leaning forward or you're going to be loop out Larry.
Yep.
And this is another thing that people forget, is that transition, as you were saying, you got to practice that, because, you know, if you don't, you're going to surprise yourself. Hole shot device. I'm saying no hole shot device. What are your thoughts?
It's preference. I can't say that because Eric Phipps is a very good friend of mine from Works Connection. That is his baby, is the hole shot, the hole shot device. I'll never say that. But yeah, some guys don't run them at Mammoth.
Because what I've heard is like some of those, you know, how you have double settings, they'll say go at least to the second setting instead of being really low. Just think about it in regards to the balance of the bike. It's one of those, if you are a little bit trepidatious of leaning forward a little bit, then I would take your starting device and just completely undo it. Somewhere in the middle, but like I say, baptism by fire in that regards. The other one too is, and I know a lot of the moto dads on 85s are going to kill me for this, but you know, this is one of those areas that it's okay to kind of slip the clutch a little bit instead of just dumping it, you know, but that's where I agree with you. You've got to practice that timing as we don't want to, because unfortunately we don't want to start creating bad habits. Yeah. It's kind of like when I'm trying to teach young riders to stay one gear taller to make the rear end of the bike softer. A lot of people forget that as the RPMs go progressively higher, the back of the bike gets progressively stiffer. Yeah. So if I can get you to keep the RPMs relatively low, so that sometimes means if you're going to take the middle or the outside lane, you might want to hit the clutch just once, but it's only to try to get the RPMs up. You're not double clutching, you know, because we know a lot of moto dads pull their hair out when their son or daughter either double clutches or refuses to let the clutch completely engage. So I understand just as you're breaking habits, we're like, oh, let's go ahead and add just a slipping of the clutch. And then you're like, you guys are full of garbage. But it definitely, because you're just trying to control that distribution and that acceleration. And then when you hit the dirt finally, then it's on like Donkey Kong.
Yeah. A lot of people stall on concrete starts because it's such a different feeling when the tire gets to start moving.
Yep.
People kind of freak out and they'll just let off the gas, don't pull the clutch, and they just stall.
Yep.
So if you can practice it, that would make a world of difference for sure.
How many bikes are on the gate at Mammoth? Is it 42?
I think it's 40. Yeah. 40 or 42.
I know this is going to sound extremely silly, but I've seen it every single year at Loretta's. Let's get it going. Everybody cranks up, right? I've literally seen people that were distracted. They thought they cranked their bike up and they didn't. I've seen it every single year at Loretta's with 41 other bikes and especially the four strokes, and they're rumbling and rumbling. I know it sounds crazy when you're listening to this. You're like, how in the heck can someone not realize that they didn't start their bike? I've seen it every year.
Yeah.
They're flipping the throttle because they're sensory overload. They're not really feeling that the bike's not vibrating underneath them. This is, by the way, when we get into some deep sports psychology, if you're so preoccupied with what's going on around you, these types of mistakes can happen. If you're so focused on yourself, right, you wouldn't let something like that happen. But I've seen it happen with some very, very successful people where they're sitting there and they dumped a clutch and they didn't realize the bike wasn't even starting.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
When you talk about stalling the bike, a lot of times, you know, obviously with having the electric start, I think there should be a rule when you go to nationals, you should not be allowed to have an electric start. Because isn't that part of the fun? If I stall that bike.
I don't know, Coach. You're talking to the wrong crowd here, dude.
Yeah.
We're all old vet guys. We want the button.
But all the vet guys grew up with, you know, us vet guys, we're looking at these young kids going, no. You need to freaking be leading a race, have a 10-second lead, and you tip the bike over and you pick it up and the damn thing won't start and you're kicking
kicking
and all of a sudden the group's catching you. Oh shoot. There goes the second place guy and you're kicking and you're kicking. Oh shoot. There's the third place guy. You're kicking and kicking. My dad's rule was you kick the bike until the race is over. We were not allowed to push the bike back. He says, if the race is still going, you keep kicking. He goes, 'cause you're in the race until the race is over. And so to this day, when I see the kids, they put the bike down and they pick it up and hit the starter. I'm like, you're missing the best part of the angst of, oh, shoot, how do I get this? And remember when the bike would flood and you're pulling the choke on
you're
kicking and kicking and kicking. Oh, I hope the listeners.
You're bringing back terrible childhood memories, Coach.
Yeah, but us that had to live it, right? We had to.
Yeah.
We had to go and collect knee-high bottles on the side of the road to get enough gas to go ride in the orange groves. And the vet riders here today, they're listening to young kids complain about their third practice bike at a facility is a little bit tired, so they don't want to ride, you know, and you're just like, seriously, come on, you know? So yeah.
Okay, I got one more listener question I want to get in before we wrap up here. This one's from Elizabeth. It says, hey Dan, my husband will be racing vet weekend in Mammoth, but he broke his collarbone, so he can't ride until then. He would like to know what kind of training you and Coach Rob would recommend in the meantime. Are there any stretches or range of motion exercises he can do to strengthen his arm? Thanks. And we are enjoying the vet podcast.
Oh, she's got a lot of meat on the bone there. Right at the very end, she said the arm. Is there any more information about the arm? Is the arm injured? Because you mentioned broken collarbone.
I don't think so. It doesn't say. I think it's collarbone, but you know, have you ever broken your collarbone?
No, sir.
It sucks.
Yeah.
It's like you don't realize how many muscles and things that you use in your body that are related to your shoulders and just all the movements. And so, yeah, your whole arm kind of is in pain.
Well, and the reason why I was asking is if we're trying to offset arm pump, right? Let's say that the athlete has problems with arm pump. I want you to remember that the muscles between your wrist and your elbows are no different than going and getting a massage on your back. It always feels better when we get a back massage or a leg massage, the big thick muscles. Don't forget to take care of your forearms. You could take a butter knife and some hand lotion and just gently scrape from your wrist towards your heart. Always good towards your heart. That's going to break up any adhesions. Because remember, you're sitting inactive. And when you're inactive like that, the muscles don't slide and glide like they should. And even if you're not injured, I would recommend that you use a butter knife and just go all the way around the arm. Scrape from your wrist to your elbow, not aggressively.
The butter knife without the serrated end.
Turn the serrated edge over, right, with some hand lotion. And then as soon as you're done, submerge your arm up to your elbow in a 5-gallon pail of cool water. And then do the alphabet with your wrist because that keeps the tissue moving. What you're doing is just doing some soft tissue maintenance. And it, like any muscle tissue, if we get the tension out, you're going to be able to have better range of motion without these forearms starting. Now, I'm going to talk about something very, very briefly that's volatile. It's worth mentioning. If you're taking testosterone, if your doctor has got you on testosterone, you have a higher propensity for arm pump. It's the number one reason for arm pump in our sport, even more so than bike position, fitness level, anything. Testosterone increases the growth of the muscle tissue. Well, think about it. The best analogy I can give you is think about sausage in the sausage casings, right? You have the casing and you can always put so much sausage in there before the casings blow. Well, that's what's happening is the muscle is surrounded with fascia. So as you increase the blood flow to that area, because one of the things, not only just the growth of muscle, but testosterone increases the red blood cell count. So now what's happening is you're increasing the amount of tension inside that casing. It's known as fascia. But I want the illustration to be sausage, casing, muscle, fascia. Now what happens is as you bring the heart rate up, there's only so much room that tissue can dilate and your arms start to feel like they're made out of cement. Or as Cooper Webb says, it's kind of like a morning wood.
Yeah.
So I just want to let people understand, especially the vet riders, when you go on to testosterone treatments, don't be surprised that you start to run into it, which puts a bigger emphasis on the maintenance of the soft tissue. Make this slide and glide as best you can, because you're already going to have some internal pressure issues. So just kind of keep that in mind. And you're not a bad guy for taking testosterone. Everybody has their reasons for it and you've gone to the doctor, but if you're on it, don't let the frustration, you know, it's the big elephant in the room that no one wants to talk about. Coming back to her question, which I'm glad that she reached out on behalf of her husband. A lot of people don't realize when you disassociate yourself with the motorcycle, that's worse than any fitness under the sun. So what I always recommend is go out in the garage. Now, this is dangerous if that collarbone hasn't healed. So don't get overzealous with this. Put the bike out on the bike stand, you know, not the kind that just has the two that holds it right by the support. I call it the old fashioned. We used to use milk crates. That's another story for another day. But with the nice bike stands that have the nice flat triangle, the square surface on the top, start by putting the bike right in the dead center and get both wheels off the ground. Now, bear with me here. You're injured. You have no way to go ride without re-aggravating that brake or that fracture or whatever the magnitude of the injury is. So what we want to do is get you reconnected with the motorcycle, not in a fluffy way, but in a realistic way, which requires get your boots on, get your knee braces on if you wear them, and your pants. Because you want to build the muscle memory as to where's that bike underneath you. Put the bike up on the stand, get both wheels off the ground. Literally go from a seated position to a standing position. Squeeze the daylights out of the bike, but don't let either wheel touch the ground. What you're working on is what's called proprioceptive balance. Where's the bike at in relationship to you? So if you go to stand up and I lean a little bit too far forward, my front wheel touches. So I realize I'm not staying centered on the bike. If my rear wheel touches it, and it's so subtle, Dan, if I go to stand up and I move back a millimeter, the back of the bike will just touch the ground. So what you're doing is you're building contact points, the bottom of your feet, your hands, your inner thighs, and you're just working on the balance of the bike. I can't emphasize that enough, whether you're injured or you're not. If you can't get access to the track, that's the number one drill you can do. And there's very simple. You start by doing it with your eyes open, stand up, sit down, try to get to where you can do 100 of those with neither wheel touching the ground. When you can, slide the bike back in the stand so you get a little bit more of a leverage point, a little bit, you increase the sensitivity. Do it again with your eyes open. Then, by the way, this is over the course of probably a year, move the bike back to the center of the stand. Try to stand up with your eyes closed without either wheel touching. You're increasing in the challenge of proprioceptive balance. Move the bike to the back of the stand. Try to stand up, sit down with your eyes closed without either one of the wheels touching. Get a couple months of that under your belt. Move the bike back to the center of the stand. Take your hands off the bars. Try to stand up without either one of the wheels touching. Slide the wheels back. Try to stand up without your hands on the bars. And then the fourth and the final is do all of that with your eyes closed. So now you've got the bike ultimately at the back of the stand with your hands by your side. You can stand up with your eyes closed and neither wheel touches the ground. That could take a couple of years. So great question coming in. When you're injured, you always want to stay in contact with the bike, and it's always those three points. And we were talking earlier about maintaining the maintenance of your wrist to your elbow. Also remember your feet and the palms, the two other contact points of the bike. When's the last time you just reached up and started working on this meaty tissue of your hand? When's the last time you took a tennis ball and just started gently working the arches of your feet? Those are all contact points on the bike. So even though you can't ride, you can keep the sensory motor awareness of those two touch points, arch of your feet and the hands. Work the bike by staying in contact from standing to sitting, because that's, without getting into a deep physics conversation, that's usually where we screw the pooch, is that transition from standing to sitting, sitting to standing, and we throw the balance of the bike off.
Yeah.
So excellent question though, Dan. I'm glad that she brought that in there, because whether you're injured or not, I think bike stand drills should be part of your repertoire.
Yep, I really agree.
They're cool. So
Coach, this one's been stuff. Awesome. I think we've given the vet riders that are looking forward to Mammoth here next month some insight on how they can prepare and what to expect. Some of it you can't expect. You just got to go experience it. And I think that's it, Coach. Anything to add last?
Nope. I just once again want to say thank you to all those who have subscribed. Thank you for reaching out to Dan and I and letting us know that these help. As we always say, this is a people's podcast. And if there's anything in particular you'd like us to dive down into, yes, we've got an outline of what we want to talk about for the next 18 months, but we're not afraid to redirect it. If there's a big fire or there's something that we think needs to be addressed, let us know and we'll definitely get on it. But yes, thank you for all those that are supporting the show. We greatly appreciate it.
Coach, thank you. Thank you, listeners. We appreciate you very much. Make sure you hit like and subscribe as well. Make sure you share with a friend, share with all your, some of the vets, Coach. It's funny because I was at the track, right? And there's some 70, 80 year old guys that we ride with in our group. They're just awesome old guys, you know?
Yeah.
But the older guys, they're not so great with the internet and stuff. So It's up to us younger vets to show the older vets how the technology works. So make sure they're not missing out on the action and some of the good stuff that we talk about. So Absolutely. Again, thank you guys all, and we'll see you on the next one.
Peace.